lawsuits. Right. He's brought five libel lawsuits himself. He sued the architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune for...
Because he didn't like his opinion.
He didn't like his opinion.
And opinions are totally protected.
So, I mean, those are the kinds of... You know, those are the kinds of judgments that make you really wonder, what does he understand about our tradition of a free press?
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you both for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Barstow, who led the New York Times team that published the explosive report on Donald Trump's tax returns, and David K. Johnston, author of The Making of Donald Trump. That does it for our broadcast. We'll be broadcasting tonight the vice presidential debate. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of AFFECT, a community event about the work, culture, and design of social change. The conference will take place October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium in Portland. AFFECT will feature talks from Spawn on Me creator and podcaster Khalif Adams, Ferguson activist and social impact designer Dee Nichols, Nadia Gathers from Code 2040, and many more. Again, that's AFFECT. October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium, 810 Northwest Marshall Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a forum on Portland and Multnomah County ballot measures on Monday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More voter information is available at lwvpd.org. And this KBOO program has also been made possible in part by Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House Internet services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net. And next is your Tuesday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Police Union contract is set to be voted on tomorrow.
Thousands take to the streets of Poland to protest a total ban on abortion.
And live in Studio 2, we talk to Neighbors for Clean Air about their upcoming rally. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 4th, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. The City of Portland is still working on the Portland Police Union contract negotiations, but the pushback from the community groups and now other city officials is considerable. The contract is set to be voted on by city commissioners at tomorrow's regular city council meeting, and Mayor Charlie Hales this week told the Portland Mercury he sees no reason to put off the vote for further discussion. Portland City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero yesterday spoke out against the proposed contract and asked for a delay in the vote. In a memo to commissioners made public, Caballero laid out conflicts of interest in the proposed union contract between Portland Police and the Office of Independent Police Review. Caballero praised Mayor Charlie Hale's decision to get rid of the 48-hour rule that prohibited the city from interviewing cops who shot people about what happened until 2 days passed. But Caballero criticizes the city's decision to negotiate with Portland Police Union representatives without including community stakeholders or the IPR itself in the talks. The new draft body camera policy does not give the IPR permission to view police videos, but it does give the officers the right to view their own video before writing up incident reports, which police accountability advocates say is, quote, problematic, because reports are supposed to be rewritten from the officer's memory. Caballero also says that the new union contract appears to delete the IPR's right to subpoena officers involved in incidents under investigation. Quote, the current collective bargaining agreement is not scheduled to expire until June 30th, 2017, Caballero says. Given the window of opportunity, enough time remains to craft a proposed contract that is informed by a more public process, end quote.
The Salem Statesman Journal today reported on the progress of the new Oregon law requiring police agencies to test completed rape kits. Hundreds of rape kits in Oregon going back to years are now getting tested, and the first batch has matched 5 kits to DNA samples in a national database. The Statesman Journal reported that state officials have so far received 335 kits back from the testing lab, and another 100 kits are still being tested. The rape kit testing law saw $1.5 million spent on hiring new staff to examine kits. Officials say this is just the start, as they expect to work through the additional 5,000 kits believed to be sitting on law enforcement shelves throughout the state. Now, police officials are debating how to decide which of those kits will be tested first.
An excessive force lawsuit has been filed against Klamath Sheriff Frank Skra, a suspect arrested in 2015. That's by a suspect arrested in 2015. Ray Bragg, who was arrested at Klamath Falls Motel with drugs and an illegal handgun, claimed Sheriff Skra threw him on the ground and began to knee him in the head before putting him in a chokehold until he passed out. Skra faces a 9-count indictment of mistreatment against Bragg and 2 other suspects. If found guilty, he could face a year in jail. A separate lawsuit has been filed against Sheriff Bragg by a former detective, Geneva Lewis. According to a letter Lewis filed in January, she was injured on the job in 2013. After out-testing 2 other applicants in 2014, she was promoted to detective. Following an interview with state investigators, she was forced by the human resources manager, who was misled by Bragg, to take medical leave. When she returned in August with a release form from her doctor, she says her position had been eliminated. She's seeking close to $700,000 in damages and reinstatement.
The mosaic of policy responses to the affordable housing crisis is growing. Next on the public agenda is inclusionary housing, which would require the local planning agency to include a percentage of new construction to be dedicated to affordable housing. The policy had been banned in Oregon for 17 years, the only state in the country with a law that deliberately blocked the policy, which some observers say has contributed to Oregon's lack of affordable housing statewide. When state lawmakers legalized inclusionary zoning this past spring, Portland officials got busy pulling housing experts together to come up with a plan. Now the city has released a draft policy including affordable housing density bonuses for participating developments, providing a percentage of the proposed dwelling units to be at certain levels of affordability, or requiring developers to pay a fee in lieu of providing on-site affordable housing units. Now the city is scheduling a briefing on the proposed policy next week, October 11th at 1 p.m. at City Hall, to lay out what's going on the table. Then on Tuesday, October 25th, the city hosts a public hearing starting at 4 p.m. at City Hall, allowing in-person public testimony about inclusionary housing. Oregon's new inclusionary housing law goes into effect February 1st, 2017.
Have you seen any scary clowns around town yet? In mid-August, multiple sightings of scary clowns were reported in South Carolina. The clown sightings have now made their way to Oregon. Last Wednesday, a Redmond woman reported seeing a person wearing a creepy clown mask with blue painted teeth. Redmond police were unable to locate any clown. This Friday, Portlander Crystal Foster said she was driving downtown when a man dressed in black with a silver clown mask approached her car, banging on the windows and trying to open the doors. In another incident, a clown was spotted on a MAX train headed to Clackamas Town Center. A witness said the clown was just sitting there staring at them with a creepy grin. As of today, sightings of scary clowns have been reported in more than 10 states. Some people have wondered if the rash of clown sightings is a marketing ploy for the remake of the movie It, based on the Stephen King novel. However, a producer for the movie has denied the studio has had any involvement.
Free tuition is coming to Portland State University. PSU has announced a new program called 4 years free. Beginning in the fall of 2017, students will have their tuition and mandatory fees covered if they meet specific qualifications. Requirements for the program include Oregon residency, acceptance into PSU, a 3.4 GPA, and qualification for the federal Pell Grant for low-income students. If accepted into the program, up to 15 credits per term would be covered, while students must maintain a minimum cumulative GPA of 2.0. Housing costs will not be included as a part of the program. Funding for the program will come from a combination of federal and state grants along with money from PSU. According to PSU's press release, students in the 4 years free program can save up to $8,400 per year. PSU expects up to 1,000 Oregonians to take advantage of the new program per year. For more, KBOO News spoke with PSU Office of Admissions and Student News Programs Executive Director, Shannon Carr. I was reading in your press release that the money is coming from a combination of federal and state grants along with money from PSU. What does that specifically mean, money from PSU?
So we have designated dollars that we put aside to assist with helping to decrease the cost of tuition for our students. We call that remission dollars. And so we're reallocating some of our existing remission dollars to help support this program specifically. And then that will come in after federal Pell grants and state opportunity grants are awarded to the students.
I know there's been some fear amongst the students because there's been lots of protest about the rise in tuition over the last few years. Is there a worry? I know that there is a worry amongst them that this might mean an increase in tuition.
Our hope is not to increase tuition, and it certainly won't be the result of this program. As we're not using any additional monies to help fund this. We're simply reallocating dollars that the university was already spending toward tuition remissions to very specifically focus on making sure that the full tuition and fees are met for Oregon residents who have a 3.4 GPA or higher and are Pell eligible.
The 4 years free program is not including housing as part of what is covered, correct?
Right. It only covers tuition and mandatory student fees.
So what resources are being offered to students in order to cover that very large expense? As we know here in Portland, housing prices and rental prices are going up. So what resources are you offering to students?
Students are certainly eligible for scholarships at the university. We have a scholarship application that's open to all students, and so students are eligible to apply for those scholarships. Students certainly can take advantage of other federal funding, including federal work study, and students can certainly help subsidize those costs through low-interest student loans. And we highly encourage students to also look for outside dollars. So there are a lot of local businesses and nonprofit organizations who really are looking to assist students with scholarship dollars. And so we're encouraging students to also look at private funding to help manage the overall cost of the overall cost of attendance.
So why is this program being implemented now?
I think it is in response to what you're talking about in terms of students just really lamenting the rising cost of tuition, and really wanting to also be a counterpart to Oregon Promise. So last year, Oregon Promise was released and specifically was helping students fund their tuition at the community college. And while that is certainly a benefit to a lot of students, there are a lot of students that want to start and are ready to start at a four-year institution. And as a school of access and opportunity, we wanted to make sure that we provided as many opportunities for students as possible to start directly at a four-year institution.
Does the word equity at all reverberate with this program?
I might ask you to clarify what you mean by that.
I guess, is this part of Portland State University's attempt to maybe rectify some of the inequities that happen here in Portland?
I don't necessarily see it as that. I really see it more as a response to making sure that resident students have the option to go to a four-year institution in a really affordable way. So I don't think we're trying to address equity necessarily. We're really just trying to make sure that access and opportunity are available to really Tri-County, but all of Oregon as well.
Critics of the 4 years free program expressed concern that the program is doing too little to address the needs of low-income students. For student perspective on PSU's tuition announcement, tune into the KBOO Evening News tomorrow night when we'll be speaking to members of the Portland State University's Student Union live in studio.
The organization Neighbors for Clean Air hosts a rally tomorrow night outside the Oregon Convention Center. The event is being held right outside the last statewide Clean Air Forum public input series by the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Here to talk about what's going on is Nicholas Caleb and Mary Pivato. Thanks for coming in tonight, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this has been a pretty eventful year for people agitating against clean air or against air pollution in Oregon. What is your take on the DEQ's public forum series of events around the state?
Well, I think that the public forum series is the first step of DEQ starting a really long process of, you know, how they're going to address establishing health-based standards in Oregon. And so we do acknowledge that it's going to take some time. It's a very new thing, but this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So we're really encouraging people to show up and let their voices be heard through these public forums and at the rally.
So what's at stake here?
Well, at stake is really the future of air emissions regulations. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity again. We've had, you know, we really have not ever had an opportunity like this to overhaul the whole way air pollution is managed and regulated in this state. And it's really critical to get this right because these regulations don't get changed very often. And it's really imperative right now to take the best science that we have and the best understanding of the risk that's posed by air toxics and get this right and make sure that we have health-based standards, enforceable health-based standards for air emissions regulations.
So earlier this year, I'm not sure if all of our listeners will remember, but Portland was pretty much in crisis from air pollution related issues. Would you say that this crisis is ongoing and that having tighter or more competent regulations in place would help address this issue?
Absolutely. I mean, the crisis that happened this year was really an awakening of knowledge by, you know, of certain hotspots of air pollution. But that isn't to say that our state hasn't known for a very long time that we've had high levels of air toxics. In fact, they had actually convened over 10 years ago a whole Portland Air Toxic Solutions program to deal with the very high concentration of unregulated air toxics. But what happened, you know, this past year was the Moss study, you know, demonstrated that these toxics are even, you know, there are more of them and in areas where we really don't know where they are. And the Moss study helped really highlight the lack of information, the lack of data, the lack of monitoring, the lack of real knowledge that people have about these risks in their own neighborhoods. But the reality is that the DEQ and the state have known for a long time that there are very large sources of air toxics that aren't well regulated either. And so it's really time to actually take this moment, take this impetus of a public mandate to get this right.
I'd also add to that the Oregon historically has had they've tended to want to do things quote unquote voluntarily and kind of behind closed doors, and we'll all just get together and sort of work out a solution to a problem, and that obviously hasn't worked. And so during this process, we're pushing for much tighter, stronger, and enforceable regulations that actually protect human health.
So to me, it seems that a lot of the crisis was to a pretty large degree a media artifact, and it was like on everyone's mind for a while because it immediately concerned everyone's health. People were concerned about cancer, about heavy metals in the air and in the ground. Had this been an issue that we only just took notice of, or did, to what degree was it overblown in your opinion by the media coverage?
Well, I wouldn't say it was overblown or over-exaggerated. I mean, I think the risk that was revealed this past year in some of these spots is very real. The question is, you know, the relative risk that we've all been facing for quite a long time. And so what we have known and what the state's known for a very long time, for example, is that diesel particulates, which is also an unregulated air toxic, puts pretty much everybody in the region at risk, but we also know is higher concentrated in areas where there are higher population of people of color. And so, and the risk that those folks have been facing that's been well known for years is something like 8,000 times some of the risk levels that people have learned that they're being exposed to by some of these toxic heavy metal hotspots. So I wouldn't say it's overblown. I think it's a reckoning, and I think it was time, and I think it's great. I think the media coverage is exactly what we needed. We need this level of awareness for the problem.
We saw that Ouroboros Glass is closing in North Portland, and that Spectrum Glass in Woodinville, Washington, closed recently, as well as citing financial problems and increased Environmental Protection Agency scrutiny. So what's your take on that? What does this signify?
Well, there was a lot in the statement that Ouroboros released recently, a lot of things like fire safety, seismic, you know, the regulations. None of it was actually calculated yet, and I think it's still yet to be seen. I mean, what the statement actually said is he's, you know, willing to put the company up for sale, and I think the market will decide whether or not it's possible to keep doing business while you do common sense safety precautions. So I think it's yet to be seen. There's actually a really strong history. I mean, of the, you know, impact of air emissions regulations actually being a benefit of the economy, coexisting with strong economic growth. California is a perfect example. It has, I think, it just moved to like the number 7 economy in the world. And they've had a really strong, incredibly health protective air toxics program for over 30 years. So I really don't think that this idea that air emissions regulations actually are a problem for economic growth, it just historically hasn't played out. Mm.
And so, actually, Nicholas, did you have anything to add on that one?
Not on that one. I think it was a very good answer.
So the Portland Tribune, and this is just kind of like tangentially related, has been covering the water pollution allegedly created by Precision Castparts at Johnson Creek. Is there any update on Precision Castparts' piece of the pollution puzzle, and how does that fit in with air quality?
Well, there has been some monitoring in the area that revealed some nickel hotspots in the area. And so people are paying attention to that. Before that, Precision Castparts began to retrofit some of their emissions stacks with new technology. We also know that there's a lawsuit that's been filed, and PCC is planning to have another community forum like they did months back in the neighborhood. And so there's quite a lot going on with PCC. And for folks that are in the South Portland area, there's a group called South Portland Air Coalition, Air Quality, excuse me, that's been working on these negotiations and putting on these public forums. And for folks that look them up on Facebook, they're very easy to find, but that's how you can plug in that neighborhood.
And I would just add, I think that the pollution in Johnson watershed, the Johnson Creek watershed, has been actually well documented, well known for years. And again, you know, this unabated, you know, large corporate polluters has really been ignored for way too long. And so I think it is a kind of reckoning time to deal with, you know, all the pollution that's going into the air and the water.
And I would add to this, there are a lot of community groups that are popping up all throughout Portland in different neighborhoods who are taking on their industrial polluters. And that's work that needs to be done. Permits need to be challenged. People need to have scrutiny. And so that work's really important. And also what we have the opportunity to do with these public forums and the Cleaner Air Oregon process is to take all this energy and direct it also toward a common solution to this problem, which is system-wide regulation as well. Because it's really hard to play this whack-a-mole game with individual polluters all over the city all the time.
Right.
All over the state.
All over the state, yeah.
So the list of coalition members participating in the demonstration tomorrow night is kind of like a roll call of activist groups. Can you talk about what your coalition approach has done for political action on these air quality issues? And is this something that is precedented?
Well, there is some precedent for coalitions in the environmental arena around climate, for example. And there are coalitions that have worked on workers' rights at the state that have been really successful. And so we're trying to borrow from some of those models that we've seen functioning. Right now, what we're trying to do is get together big, small nonprofits, community action groups, health organizations, government entities, pretty much everybody who's interested in solving this problem once and for all. Many of those groups who have also been fighting this battle for a really long time to start asserting ourselves in a more forceful manner. And I think that even now, I mean, we're really happy about the groups that we're working with, and I think we'll continue to grow. And there are a lot of voices that aren't necessarily represented yet that we can add to that as well. And so folks that are business owners that want to get involved in this and talk about how clean air will be good for business, which, as Mary mentioned, is generally the case, or even people that want to sell the city of Portland, you know, having an environment that's relatively clean is usually a good selling point to potential employees. There is a lot of room for our coalition to grow. And if you're listening and you're interested, feel free to contact us, and we would love to talk to you about including you in the coalition even more.
Nicholas, you're the staff attorney for Neighbors for Clean Air. What legal issues are you looking at right now? And who would you say the chief opponents are to getting clean air in our neighborhoods?
Well, we're mostly focused on regulatory issues at the state level. And what we've historically seen, our opponents are members of industry, and specifically stationary industry, a lot of folks located in the Northwest Industrial District and then having factories around the state, and also trucking and transportation industry. those are the groups that have pushed back the most on air toxics reform in the past. And unfortunately, it's not even sort of a bickering over details. A lot of these groups have just denied that there's a toxics problem to get altogether. And we're already seeing that again. And a lot of these groups that we've been in so far, industry representatives want to challenge the science on everything, say the modeling is inaccurate, but not to say the problem is worse than we don't know about it, but to say that there's no problem at all. And so, you know, I think we are confident that we work with a lot of scientists who have studied this problem for a long time in our state. We think the science is clear, at least in terms of having enough information to take action now.
So we're just about out of time, but I want to get down to the event tomorrow. Can you talk about who's speaking and what the details are so our listeners can show up?
Yeah, so we're going to meet tomorrow at the Oregon Convention Center from 5 to 6. It'll be in the northeast section of the convention center near the transit center. And we've got five really good speakers who are lined up, and they'll lead us into the forum itself. So Alma Velasquez from the Coley Air Action Team, she'll give a speech about her community activism in English and Spanish. Dana Jones from Opal Environmental Justice and also Lewis and Clark Law School will speak. She's a very, very excellent speaker, also mother of three. Dr. Susan Katz from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility will talk about the health effects of air pollution. Rob Nose, local representative, District 42, I think. Southeast Portland will be there speaking. And then Chris Winter from Craig Law Center, who's a very talented attorney and good speaker, will also lead us in.
Well, there's no scarcity of things to talk about relating to air quality, but we're just about out of time. I want to thank you both for coming on. This has been very enlightening.
Yeah, thanks
thank
for having
you.
Us.
Thanks so much for having us.
So that was Mary and Nicholas, Mary Pivoteau and Nicholas Caleb of Neighbors for Clean Air. The Rally for Clean Air is on Wednesday, October 5th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. Co-hosts and endorsing organizations include Oregon Physicians for Responsibility, Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, Craig Law Center, Beyond Toxics, Opal Environment, Justice Oregon, South Portland Air Quality, Eastside Portland Air Coalition, North Portland Air Quality, Neighbors for Clean Air, and 350 PDX.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news in depth with an interview with Donald Lacey about his one-man production, Colorstruck, at 5:45, followed by Transpositive at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Willamette Valley will be rainy with a chance of thunderstorms during the day and showers in the evening. East of the Cascades in Hood River, there's a slight chance of rain during the day with partly cloudy skies at night. And today in history, in 1957, Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth, was launched. The quote of day is from scientist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who said, "The Pacific is the best toilet for satellites."
In West York, Pennsylvania, Mayor Charles Wasco is being heavily criticized for posting racist memes on Facebook. Townspeople are calling for the mayor to step down after the mayor posted on Facebook memes suggesting President Barack Obama should be lynched and others depicting the first family as a bunch of orangutans. Last Monday, West York City Council voted to censor Wasco, also voting to expand any legal means of removing him from office. Despite all of this, Mayor Wasco is unapologetic, stating, quote, "I will not be politically correct. I say what is on my mind, and I say what I believe in."
Hurricane Matthew hit the southern shores of Haiti today. The Category 4 hurricane has had up to 145 mph winds, destroying homes and farms along its path. Flooding on the island is blocking transportation routes and is slowing aid efforts to certain areas. Due to the damages in the nation's communication network, the number of casualties and the extent of the damages remain unclear. Haiti has not seen a hurricane this large since 1960. The aid organization UNICEF estimates that up to 4 million children could be at risk of waterborne illnesses associated with unsafe drinking water. Cholera is also a concern, with Haiti battling the disease since foreign aid workers brought it into the country after the 2010 earthquake. Hurricane Matthew is continuing to move up the East Coast, with it being expected to make landfall in Florida by the end of this week.
Protesters in Poland declared yesterday as Black Monday. Thousands of people marched through the street of the country's capital protesting a proposed law that would virtually ban all abortions. As part of the protest, women from all parts of Poland boycotted work, shutting down some government offices. Poland already has some of the most restrictive abortion laws in Europe, leaving many to question the need for even stricter regulation. Current Polish laws ban abortion except when the mother's life is in danger, the pregnancy is a result of rape or incest, or if the fetus is irreparably damaged. The proposed law would ban all abortions, without exception. Critics of the anti-abortion law say they worry about what a total ban could mean for doctors and women. Doctors could face years in prison for performing procedures that attempt to save both the life of the mother and fetus. Women who have an abortion could face up to 5 years in prison. Women who cannot prove that their miscarriage wasn't induced could also face prison time. Protests in other cities around Poland and Europe took place on Monday as well.
Amnesty International issued a scathing report today on the state of the global refugee crisis, calling the recent UN summit on refugees a spectacular failure and criticizing most of the world's wealthiest nations for doing the least to address the needs of 21 million refugees worldwide. The report titled "Tackling the Global Refugee Crisis from Shirking to Sharing Responsibility" does name two countries that have stepped up to the call, Germany and Canada. In December 2015, Canada opened its doors to 25,000 Syrian refugees fleeing civil war. Across the country, families arrived from the Middle East to start a new life. The welcome, led by the newly elected Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his Liberal Party, became a nationwide effort with Canadians from coast to coast opening their hearts, homes, and kitchens. Daniel Castle reports.
Asma El Hariri chops zucchinis in a downtown Toronto kitchen. She is one of a dozen Syrian women preparing tonight's newcomer kitchen meal. The dish? Sheikh El Mashi Bil Laban, a traditional Levantine recipe consisting of zucchinis stuffed with beef, cooked in a yogurt sauce thickened with eggs, and seasoned with garlic and mint, accompanied by Egyptian rice. Restaurant and culinary incubator The Depanneur hosts the newcomer kitchen. The initiative started out as a space for Syrian women to prepare home-cooked meals for their families while they were stuck in hotels upon arrival in Toronto, and has since grown into a weekly takeout restaurant. Asma has been participating in the project for more than 3 months.
Well, I love cooking. Yes, I love cooking, and I love to share and participate in this project because I want to be in touch with Canadian people, with the Syrian people also in my community.
Each Thursday morning, the Syrian women arrive, sometimes with children in tow, at the Depanneur to cook 50 pre-ordered meals for customers around Toronto. The women range in age from 25 to 72 and come from every corner of Syria. Some know each other from their early days in hotels, and some are meeting for the first time. But they all share similar goals: to make delicious meals, earn some cash, and build a life in Toronto. Asma says knowing English has helped her transition to life in Canada, but that she's still adjusting.
It's a new culture, a new style of life, new country. So that's the big challenge for me, to be accustomed to the traditions, to the customs of the Canadian, to the way of life. And the big challenge is to find a job here, yes. For us as newcomers, it's a big challenge to find a job.
Although the newcomer kitchen was not started as an income-generating project, it does provide pocket money to the women. Each participant leaves with around $75 for a day's work and can also take home leftovers for their families.
The social benefit of all of them coming together and interacting and cooking and sharing. They're incredibly proud, incredibly capable. They're eager to show what they can do and to share what they love about their culture with the Canadian community.
The Depanneur's owner, Len Senator, says the real value of the newcomer kitchen goes beyond the weekly token payment.
The fact that we can do something that generates a transaction, an equitable transaction, something of mutual benefit, that they can create something of true value that, and the other people can recognize the value and are happy and willing to pay for it, creates for a really dignified exchange. And that, I think, is really the foundation of an amazing type of interaction. It's not charity. It's they've earned this money through hard work, and they're getting something fair for it in return, and the people are getting an amazing meal, and everybody goes away happy.
Additional revenue comes from locals like Don Scarrow, who paid to attend the week's cooking session to learn how to prepare Syrian cuisine.
It's such a good idea. It's just such a good idea for everybody to participate and then for people in Toronto to get to taste it. Why not? And what an amazing opportunity. The price is right. The food is fantastic. Everybody gets something out of it. So.
The project got off its feet thanks to Rahaf Al-Akbani and her husband Ishmael Abu Fakhr, a young Syrian couple who came to Canada as refugees earlier this year. The couple met Len at a fundraiser and drew on their interpreting and social work backgrounds to connect a handful of refugee women with the kitchen space. Now the couple coordinates more than 50 women in the Greater Toronto area who regularly participate in the project. Rahaf says it's a lot of work, but worth it to see the women so happy.
Actually, they said that they are very happy by this project, and always insist that I want to come. Please, they always call me and my husband, when we want to come again, because we had fun, and you know, they got the benefit financially, so they want to support their families, and they always, please, don't forget me, I'm in the waiting list.
Singing classics by famed Lebanese songstress Farouz, it's clear the women are enjoying their work and having fun at the newcomer kitchen. In an attempt to establish a standalone kitchen with salaried positions, Len has launched a fundraiser campaign and applied for charity status. He says the newcomer kitchen model can be successfully applied in other cities resettling refugees. This dream is shared by many of the women involved, including Rahaf.
I see that the newcomer kitchen will grow up and it will be a huge project. So, you know, and the idea that maybe there will be a copy over the world, like what Len did. So, because it's a good idea.
With the support of Toronto's mayor and many immigration organizations in the city, it shouldn't be long until more Torontonians are enjoying home-cooked Syrian cuisine. Tanya Castle, FSRN, Toronto.
And now a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the Community Rights Report by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos, bringing you stories of we the people reclaiming our power to govern ourselves and ending the absurdity of corporations exercising constitutional rights. We Portlanders love our city, but major changes are coming and many of us are very upset about those changes. I'm talking about the fact that Portland has the number one tightest rental housing market of any major city in the U.S., that Portland rents are rising at a breathtaking pace, and thousands of us are being displaced because landlords can evict renters with no cause, which translates into ever-growing numbers of homeless people, and that hundreds of perfectly good homes are being demolished by developers to make way for new monster homes. These changes will inevitably destroy the very qualities of our city that so many of us have worked so hard to create over many decades. So it's no wonder that it feels like an emergency situation to many of us. And yet most of us feel both hopeless and powerless that these changes can be stopped. We need to come up with a truly expansive and courageous strategy and vision quickly to stop the destruction of our beloved city, and I honestly believe we Portlanders are capable of doing this. There are some wonderful organizations already mobilizing residents to respond to this housing crisis, such as Portland Tenants United and the Community Alliance of Tenants. My fear is that the tactics and strategies being employed by these and other social justice groups are not properly scaled for the critical challenge we face. Rallies and marches and pickets and home occupations can only go so far as a response to the ongoing no-cause evictions, massive rent increases, and demolitions. Why? Because everything the developers and demolishers are doing is fully protected by law. whereas what concerned residents want is actually in opposition to those existing laws. Why? Because our nation was founded on the idea that those who own property have more constitutionally protected rights than those who do not own property. Who gets to decide whether a perfectly fine home is going to be bulldozed to make way for a monster home that's totally out of character with the existing neighborhood? The person or corporation that owns the property, that's who. Even a majority of neighborhood residents have no constitutionally protected rights in this situation at all. And who gets to decide whether a decent long-term tenant is going to lose their housing when property values go up? The person or corporation that owns that rental property. Again, those who rent homes or apartments have no constitutionally protected rights in this situation at all. In a democratic republic based on majority rule, this makes absolutely no sense. So we, the people of Portland, need to stand up collectively and change this absurd situation, and we actually can. If in fact tens of thousands of Portlanders already believe that this is an emergency situation, then let's mobilize ourselves the way the people of other nations do all the time. If we really are serious about protecting the qualities of Portland that make it so special, we have no time to lose. Why haven't we already begun to do this? Because we're told that cities do not have the authority to pass local laws that prohibit no-cause evictions or massive rent increases or the demolition of perfectly fine homes. Only state legislatures can do that, we're told. And in the conventional way of thinking about law, that's actually true. But that's only because we have forgotten what the proper relationship is between we the people and our government, which is constitutionally required to serve us, which has duties and responsibilities to us. Don't believe me? Let's review the first paragraph of our Oregon State Constitution. Here's an excerpt. Article 1, Bill of Rights, Section 1, Natural Rights Inherent in People. All power is inherent in the people, and they have at all times a right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper. So let's stop pleading with our local and state elected officials to save us, and let's start exercising our constitutional authority to respond boldly to this emergency situation in our beloved city. In cooperation with our existing tenants' rights groups and other social justice organizations, let's draft an emergency Portland ballot initiative that bans no-cause evictions and prohibits landlords from dramatically raising the rent. And as we mobilize ourselves, let's think about other related urgent issues that we might choose to include, like protecting the rights of homeless people, the rights of people in home foreclosures, the rights of neighborhood majorities, and the rights of heritage trees. We have the knowledge and the will to draft a housing bill of rights to bring to Portland voters. Imagine how quickly we could protect our city, under law, if thousands of Portlanders got involved. What do you think? I want to hear from you. Please, please contact me via my website. Thank you. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CienfuegosPaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Give us a call with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Khan, Jenny Yokoyama, and Lisa Loving. The producer is Jenny Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland speaks with Jessica Applegate of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition, Paul Koberstein of Cascadia Times, and Greg Bourget, Executive Director of Portland Air, about toxic air in Portland. At 9, it's Political Perspectives. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show features Rebecca Hamilton and Scott Cohen, who will talk about Portland State University class on transportation options and making neighborhoods more bicycle-friendly and safe. And PSU professor Aaron Golub presents his research on cycling within a broader social justice framework. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for KBOO Community Radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. That's the news. Night, Jenna.
Hi, Kanan. Night, Wesley.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
David Dee, himself a professor in Africana Studies at San Francisco State University, speaks backstage with activist Donald Lacey about his upcoming one-man production of Color Struck in San Francisco, California.
David Dee, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We were listening to a little excerpt, Donald Lacey, in action here at San Francisco State, his old alma mater, came through talking to people about the role of the artist and where he sees things going. First of all, Donald, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And I just wanted to get your take on things, man. We're in historical moments. A historic election on the corner, around the corner. Police terrorism is front and foremost. What's happening with our Native brothers and sisters in the Dakotas? Seems like a lot of things are turned up. But when I talk to people who's been around for a long time, they're saying this is almost a repeat of 68, 69, and that that we should study the past so we kind of know what sort of steps to take in the future. How are you seeing things?
Well, first of all, always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me in this wonderful time sharing with your students. You have a great class, and you're really molding some really